creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
In 1965, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference joined a voting rights protest march from Selma, Alabama, to the state capital of Montgomery, more than 50 miles away. The goal of the march was to draw national attention to the struggle for black voting rights in the state. Police beat and tear gassed the marchers just outside of Selma. Televised scenes of the violence, on a day that came to be known as Bloody Sunday, resulted in an outpouring of support to continue the march. Joanne Bland is the co-founder of the National Voting Rights Museum and Institute in Selma, Alabama. Joanne Bland is the co-founder of the National Voting Rights Museum and Institute in Selma, Alabama. She began her civil rights activism in 1961 as an 8-year-old attending a Freedom and Voters' Rights meeting presided over by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In the front lines of the struggle, the young Bland marched on Bloody Sunday and Turnaround Tuesday, witnessing brutal beatings, shootings, and hosing of fellow marchers by police. Being only 11 years old at the time, she has the distinction of being the youngest person to have been jailed in these demonstrations. Ms. Bland continues to be active in local and regional organizations devoted to expanding and securing civil and human rights. These include the SCLC and the NAACP, to name a couple. Today, Ms. Bland tells us her story of being a freedom fighter, and we hear details of Bloody Sunday and how activism changed her life. In honor of Black History Month, KQAL features Ms. Joanne Bland in her talk, Growing Up in the Segregated South, Selma Voting Rights Movement, presented at the Winona Senior High School. You're listening to Culture Click.
Thank you. I grew up doing segregation in the South. It's a whole different world. I know you have no connection to that. While she was introducing me, I just felt so old. Didn't you feel like I was ancient when she said that I had participated in so much? But the truth of the matter is that these events didn't happen that long ago. I am old by your standards, but the first one calls me old, gets a beat down. I flunked nonviolence in the 60s, okay? Violence in any form is wrong. And I've come a long, long way. But if you hit me while I'm in Minnesota, it's on. It comes right back. You got that? My grandmother, Sylvia Johnson, came to live with us when I was 3 years old. My mom died in the halls of a hospital in Selma, a white hospital, because they refused to treat her. She left four little kids. I was the second youngest. I was 3 years old. My grandmother came from Detroit, and she couldn't understand, after being gone for over 40 years, how things had not changed in the South since she had left. We still had segregation. We still had signs that said, no Negroes allowed, colored seated in the rear, whites only. Colored bathroom, white bathroom. She said, that's not right. We also had no representation in the political arena. Grandmother met this woman named Amelia Boynton. Amelia Boynton was a farm extension agent. She and her husband, Sam, they had formed an organization in the 1930s called the Dallas County Voters League. And their main mission was to just register African Americans to vote, because they felt if we had a voice in the political arena, we could change some of the laws that were unfair to us, being a majority in Selma. Selma is majority African American to this day, yet we had no one to represent us in that arena. They started to have meetings at the Boynton's house. And grandmother would take us to the meetings, boring. I had to sit at the feet of those history makers while they strategized how they was gonna get this thing called freedom. Freedom? I knew what we already had our freedom. My third grade teacher, Ms. Boyd, had told me that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. Obviously, these adults didn't know it. I felt smug in my belief that I was the smartest person in that room. One day, my grandmother was downtown, what we call downtown. It's just one little street, about six little blocks of stores, okay? I live in a small town. We were standing in front of Carter's drugstore. Carter's had a lunch counter. Every time I pass by Carter's or go in Carter's, I see the white kid sitting at the lunch counter, licking on an ice cream cone, drinking a milkshake from this tall, beautiful glass. And I wanted to do that. Grandmother said I couldn't. I said, why, Grandma? She said, because we're colored. Colored children cannot sit at the counter. Didn't stop me from wanting to sit at that counter. Every time I pass by there, I'd be looking in that mirror, in that window, trying to see, watching those white kids wishing it was me. Well, one day, we were standing in front of the store, and my grandmother noticed me peeping in the window, and she leaned over my shoulder, and she said, when we get our freedom, you can do that too. I became a freedom fighter that day. I understood instantly that Grandma was going for the good freedom. Abraham Lincoln had given me a freedom, but not the good freedom. The good freedom would allow me to sit at that counter. I started going to the meetings of SNCC. SNCC is S-E-N-C-C, and it stands for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The meetings were being held less than a block from my house at First Baptist Church. I started going with my older sisters. They tried to teach me the principles of nonviolence, and they talked about how we, as young people, could participate in bringing about this change. I didn't like the nonviolent part. You know, they'd be yelling at you and up in your face, talking and spitting at the same time. I hated that. I'd fight back. They started sending me outside when the training started. You can go outside and play now. I go too. James Bevel, who organized the Selma to Montgomery Mars, used to tell the story of him trying to train me, and I was untrainable, that he was yelling at me one day, acting like he was the police, and I bit him on his knee. He shouldn't have been up in my face, and while I'm sitting on the floor, that was as close as I could get to his head. I wanted to bite his head off, but all I could get to was the knee. Now, soon we started marching too, the young people. Started going to the courthouse. Our board of registrars, where you register to vote, was at our courthouse on the first floor. We started organizing groups and walking down to the courthouse. We get there and they wouldn't let us in. Wouldn't let us in at all. So we kneel on the steps of the courthouse. Someone would say a prayer. We would pray to the Creator that He would lift the hearts of these evil men and let our parents register to vote so they could vote for us until we could vote for ourselves. That got old quick. They started arresting us, taking us to jail. Now, jail was kind of fun and kind of bad, too. They would put us in cells that were supposed to hold one to two people. Never been in a cell that had less than 40 people all jammed up in it. Toilet in the middle of the floor. With that many people in a room, you don't want to be anywhere near a toilet. The bed, if you were lucky enough to get the bed, you didn't sit there long. They had taken the mattress. All you had was this metal frame to sit on. The food, dry beans. For those of you who cook beans or have seen people cook beans, no, you can't just open that pack and pour it in the water. You have to pick out the stuff you cage. You know, the rocks, the dirt, the insects. Nobody did that for us. I think they took pride in bringing you a plate with a big old rock sitting up on it. You wouldn't have eaten it, would you? Girl, by that third day, you've been so hungry, you'd push that rock aside and hope you couldn't identify what you were crunching on. You'd be just that hungry. Those things were done to break our spirits. But we were as low as we could go. We didn't have any rights. None of the rights you enjoy today are the freedoms. We get home and be the same thing. We go home, eat a good meal, take a bath, and be right back at the church, oftentimes going back to jail the same day. By the time I was 11, I had gone to jail 13 times. 13 times. And those are the ones we could document. In December of 1964, a letter was written by the Dallas County Voters League to a man named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., inviting him to Selma. Dr. King just didn't show up in Selma one day and say, I'm going to Selma. Not many people do that. He already knew of the work that the League had been doing for 30-some-odd years. He accepted the invitation. He spoke on Emancipation Proclamation Day. He met with the members of the Dallas County Voters League. When Dr. King accepted his Nobel Peace Prize, he told not only this nation, but the entire world, that my hometown, Selma, Alabama, would be the battleground for voting rights in these United States. Things really heated up when Dr. King came. He brought his lieutenants and he stationed them at counties all around us. He sent James Orange, Reverend James Orange, to a town called Marion. Marion is about 30 miles west of Selma. It's the county seat of Perry County. In Marion, Reverend Orange found it easier to organize students rather than adults. It was easier to organize the students because their parents worked for the people who were trying to keep us from getting the right to vote. Approximately 600 of them marched on their courthouse, and all 600, including Reverend Orange, were arrested. Reverend Orange himself told me about 3 o'clock that day, a state trooper came into the area where he was housed. He had a rope. On the end of that rope was tied a noose. He threw the rope over the top of his cell and left. Reverend Orange said he had to sit there all day long, knowing that it may very well be his last day on earth. That evening, they let the young people out. They kept Reverend Orange. A mass meeting was being held approximately a block away from the jail at this church. The children ran into the church and disrupted the meeting. They said, you have to do something. You have to do something now. They're going to kill him. The people in the church decided to go down to the jail and walk around it all night long in hopes that their mere presence would save this man's life. When they left the church, they were attacked and brutally beaten by law enforcement officers. A young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson emerged from the church just in time to see a state trooper beating his grandfather, his 82-year-old grandfather. Jimmy ran over and he pleaded with this trooper, please don't beat my grandfather. He's an old man. If he's done something wrong, take him to jail. Jimmy's mother saw them beating her father too. And she ran over. As she approached, that trooper drew back his billy club to hit her. Jimmy put up his hand to stop him. That trooper shot him. Jimmy died 8 days later. It was then that the leaders decided to walk from Selma to Montgomery, 54 miles, to protest Jimmy's death and demand the right to vote from our then Governor George Wallace. On March 7, 1965, we gathered on the playground behind Brown Chapel, and led by John Lewis and Hosea Williams, we walked up to the Edmund Pettus Bridge to begin our trek to Montgomery. When we walked across the bridge, we were met by a line of policemen. And that line stopped John Lewis, asked permission to pass. The policeman said, there will be no march between Selma and Montgomery. You have 3 minutes to go back to your church. In 1 minute and 15 seconds, they attacked. It was awful. I had never experienced violence. Marching was fun to me. I liked the spirit of the movement, being with my friends, not going to school. I liked all of that. When I crested that bridge and I saw those policemen, I knew we were not going to Montgomery. I was a warrior, so I knew the procedure. I had marched enough to know what was going to happen. When that line stopped, I was too far back to see what was happening. I didn't need to see. I knew that when permission was denied, John and Hosea would go down on their knees and we would follow suit. I'm standing there waiting for the front to go down when suddenly I heard gunshots and screams. I thought they were killing the people down front. Before we could turn to run, it was too late. They came in from both sides, the back and the front, just beating people old, young, black, white, male, female. It didn't matter. They were just beating people. You know what I remember the most? The screams. People were screaming and screaming. People lay everywhere, bleeding, not moving, as if they were dead. It was horrible. The gunshots I heard were not gunshots. They were tear gas canisters being shot into the crowd. Tear gas burns your eyes, gets in your nose, gets in your lungs. You can't breathe, you can't see, you panic. Oftentimes running right back to the same people you were running from. It was awful. If you could outrun those men on foot, you couldn't outrun the ones on horses. The horses were afraid. They were rearing and kicking. People were being trampled. Bones were being broken. The last thing that I remember seeing on that bridge that day is this horse and this lady. And I don't know what happened. Did the horse run over her? The man on the horse hit her and she fell? I don't know. I do know, as I stand before you almost 46 years later, I can still hear the sound her head made when it hit that pavement. The next thing I remember is being in a car on the Selma side of the bridge. My head was in my sister Linda's lap, and Linda was crying. When I became fully awake, I realized what was falling on my face were not her tears. It was her blood. My 14-year-old sister had been beaten on that bridge and had wounds in her head that required 26 stitches. Yet on that Tuesday when Dr. King came back, I held that same sister's hand as we followed he and Dr. Abernathy across that bridge again. When I crested that bridge, young people, and I saw those same policemen, I don't mind telling you I was afraid. I didn't want to go. I didn't want any more freedom. The price was just too much for this 11-year-old. I kept trying to go back, but she held my hand firmly, and she kept telling me it's going to be all right. And the people around her were coaxing, too. Finally, my sister said, "They're not going to beat Dr. King. Come on." I went, but I was scared. Dr. King asked permission to pass this time. The policeman said the same thing. There would be no march between Selma and Montgomery. But this time the front went down. Dr. Abernathy said a prayer. And after prayer, he and Dr. King stood up and led us back to Brown Chapel AME Church, my church, where he held a mass meeting. At that mass meeting, he told us he had applied for a court order that would give us the legal right to walk from Selma to Montgomery and, most importantly, be protected. It was signed on March 17th by a judge in Montgomery named Frank Johnson. And on March 21st, we left Brown Chapel one more time, came over that same Edmund Pettus Bridge. And those same policemen who beat us up on the 7th had to protect us all the way from Selma to Montgomery. It took 5 days of walking. There are no motels between Selma and Montgomery today. There were none then. People slept on the ground. It started raining on the second day. Nobody turned around. They kept going. And do you know that it was less than 6 months later that the Voting Rights Act was signed, and it removed those obstacles that prevented us from voting? In Selma, which is the county seat of Dallas County, we went from 150 African Americans on the rolls to 9,600 almost immediately. Those things happened almost 100 years after the Emancipation was signed. You know, when Abraham Lincoln gave me my freedom. Yet 100 years later, I'm still fighting for the freedom. If truth be told, for every right that the Emancipation gave me, I had to struggle for. And we're still struggling. We've come a long, long, long way. It's just that we have a long, long, long way to go. Today, our problems are not so clear as to be defined by race. What affects me affects you. What affects you affects me. If something's wrong in your community, it's wrong in mine. Because if you don't stamp it out in your community, it's coming to mine. And then I got the same problem. Something's wrong with that if you don't get rid of it. Maybe I should be over there helping you. What do you think? Get rid of it. Because I don't want it in my community. It's not a separate movement. It's not to give me my freedom. It's to make sure that we have a better world. And just yesterday, we celebrated the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, Dr. King's vision was not just for me. It was not just for you or you. It was for us, for all people, that one day we recognize people as people and these ills would go away once and for all. My grandmother used to have this saying, and I hope you understand it as young people. She used to tell us mighty rivers were filled drop by drop. I used to look at the Alabama River and say, ooh, it took a long time to fill that one if it was drop by drop. But now I know that if you add your drop, your drop, your drop, your drop, all these drops, that soon and very soon we'll have a mighty river that would wash all this craziness away once and for all. You just got to add your drop. You have to ask yourself daily, what can I do to make this world a better place? It's every generation's responsibility to make the world a little bit better for the next generation. What are you going to do? Thank you.
We now go to a Q&A segment with Joanne Blackman as she answers questions from students at the Winona Senior High School. The first question was, did you ever get to meet Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
I was a kid, so if you guys laugh at me, I'm going to cry, okay? The first time that I saw Dr. King, I didn't meet him. He was speaking at Tabernacle Baptist Church. My older sister came home. It was a Saturday. My older sister came home and she said, get dressed. Grandmother's taking us to see King. My brother and I were so excited. We're going to see King. We put on our Sunday best without, you know how you don't want to get dressed up? They had to fight with us to get dressed, but we didn't have any problem putting on our Sunday best to go see King. We were so excited. And when we got to the church, it was not out of the ordinary for our events to be doing segregation to be held at our churches. They were the largest gathering places and that we could go in peace. But when we got to the church, we saw all these cars and all these adults. We're like, my goodness, everybody loves King, right? So we go into the church. We find grandmother and preacher after preacher, song after song, and then it's over. Where's King? Grandma, where's King? Oh, that was him, the last speaker that spoke. Didn't you listen to Dr. King? Dr. King? We thought we were going to see a dog. There was a show that used to come on Saturday morning called The Royal Mounted Police. Anybody of that age group? The Royal Mounted Police. And the Mountie had a dog, a German Shepherd named King. My feelings are hurt. We thought we were going. Nevertheless, he had to win his way into my heart. But Dr. King was one of those people who loved young people. He loved the young people. We could get to him when no one else could. The other ministers and leaders around us would be shooing us away, and he'd see us and say, come on, come here. And when he asked you how your day was going, you wanted to tell him. You wanted to stay there with him. He just had this aura that made you, like it was like a magnet being around him, and that you felt so special. He always had a peppermint in his pocket, and he would always give us a peppermint. And he had the softest hands I ever felt on anyone, including my grandmother. As I grew older, I also realized that since he didn't do manual labor, they should have been soft. But I remember his hands and his voice the most.
The next question Joanne answered was whether or not she was ever scared.
I did cry the very first time I went to jail, and I was with my grandmother. We had gone to the courthouse along with about 60 other women and children, right? When we got there, we had a colored entrance to the courthouse during segregation, right? As we climbed the entrance to the door of the colored entrance, a white lady inside ran to this double door with a sheet of paper, and she taped it on the door, and it had some writing on it. As I got closer, I saw it said, "Out to lunch." I remember thinking, white people sure eat early. It's still morning, and they're already gone to lunch. Grandma wouldn't feed us till hours from now. Dog, I wish I was white. I could eat again. Period. And she locked that door. Now, I couldn't understand why the adults were still standing there. The people gone to lunch. Let's go and come back when they come from lunch. You know, I'm standing there thinking. I didn't have the nerve to say it out loud. I could hear the traffic on Alabama Avenue. I heard a different sound. And I looked back and I saw two yellow school buses. They drove up and stopped right behind us. And the policemen start getting off. And they start grabbing the women and their children, leading them to the buses. I got excited again. I was so excited. I said, "Grandma, can I sit by the window?" She said, "Yeah, baby, you can sit by the window." We get on this bus. It rolls three blocks, stop right in front of the city jail. I said, "Grandma, why are we here?" She said, "They're going to arrest us." And I began to cry. She said, "Don't worry, baby, things are going to change." You know why I was so excited? I had never ridden a school bus. School buses were for white kids in the South. No matter where, how far your school was, you had to walk. In any kind of weather, and you had to be there on time. And now I get the chance to ride a school bus, and it takes me to jail. I was 8 years old at that time. And yes, I was scared.
Up next, a student asked Joanne when she herself first noticed progress.
You know, that's hard to answer because the day I became a freedom fighter, I thought things would get better. To notice progress, I was in the Army for 20 years, right? Don't ask. I wasn't defending y'all against nobody. I was a legal clerk. I could carry my computer, not a weapon. It's a good thing I never got tested because they would have thrown me out. I was afraid of the gun. But when I came back home, I saw black businesses on our main street. And not just the normal, you know, food, hair, and death. You know, attorneys and just in all segments of our society up and down these streets, right? When we found a building for the museum, it was on the side of our main street that I had never, ever been on. We have made progress, right? But then I realized that the power structure hadn't changed. You know, as you get into it, you realize that there's still problems and things are still not the way they should be. For one thing, if I can look on this side of town and tell you live there and you can look on this side of town and tell I live over there, something's still wrong, right? So I saw progress, and like I said, we've come a long, long way, but we still got a long, long way to go, don't we? But that's okay. I'm in good hands. I feel good about you guys.
A question was raised whether or not other people belonging to another race other than African American helped during the Selma rights voting movement.
Of course. Justice lovers come in all colors. Justice fighters don't have a color. That if you know something's wrong and you don't say anything, what does that make you? No matter what your race is, right? That's one of the problems. When we see wrongs, we don't say anything because you feel like it does not affect you. It will. It will. Because if you don't get rid of it with me while it's in my face, it's going to be in yours tomorrow. So justice levels come in all colors. They call it a black movement because we benefited the most. The power structure in the United States hadn't changed a whole lot, but was really worse than it is now, okay? But there were people who didn't look like me, who knew it was wrong. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And they came. And I'm glad. I'm grateful for that. Surely you would have been a freedom fighter. Surely you're going to do your part to make things better now, right? Right? You don't have to answer that, sweetheart.
The final question asked of Joanne Blackman was whether or not she actually got to sit at the counter at the drugstore that she once wanted to as a child.
You know, no. But guess what? I am. It's no longer there. But friends of mine purchased a building, and they're putting a lunch counter in on the first floor, complete with the description of the stools and the decor that I described. And guess who's going to sit there first? I'm going to be all over Facebook spinning around on that stool. Watch and see. Thank you. You've been a good audience.
A very special thank you to Ms. Joanne Blackman Bland for taking the time to share with us her talk on the Selma voting rights movement. Tune in to Culture Click next week for our one-on-one interview with Ms. Bland on how activism has changed her life, her personal struggles, and achievements. Ms. Bland's talk was co-sponsored by Winona State University, Southeast Technical College, the City of Winona, the Winona Human Rights Commission, and Anoka Ramsey Community College. Thank you to all of you who made Ms. Bland's visit possible. You've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.